everyone. I'm Jennifer Cook, Director of the Africa Program here at CSIS. Welcome to all of you for this session to take a look, to hear from Scott Strauss on recent volume, Remaking Rwanda. I guess we're going to have a few more people trickling in. But I think we'll just go ahead and get started. Scott Strauss is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and together with Lars Waldorf at the Center for Applied Human Rights at the University of York, is co-editor of Remaking Rwanda, a copy of which he has there, State Building and Human Rights After Mass Violence, which he'll talk about today. Scott has written extensively on Rwanda over the years, including in 2006, The Order of Genocide, Race, Power, and War in Rwanda, An Intimate Enemy, Images and Voices of the Rwandan Genocide. I was particularly impressed by this, translated Jean-Pierre Chrétien's The Great Lakes of Africa, which is a massive volume on thousands of years of Congolese history, from French into English. So kudos on that, by the way. English, African students, Africa study students everywhere will be thanking you, because it's very hard to plow through in French. So we're delighted to welcome here today to talk about this volume, which really, I think it was inspired by the work of Alison DeForge, who was kind of an inspiration for so many of us for her foresight, her knowledge, her balance. And this volume, I think, brings together analysis and assessment from a wide range of scholars from a variety of disciplines and human rights professionals, each of whom delves into a particular facet of Rwanda's post-conflict recovery. I think with insight, with a strong research foundation and long country experience. The collective result is a comprehensive, I think, thoughtful, an informed critique of the country's post-conflict trajectory, and it has to be said, a troubling assessment of where Rwanda might be heading and the challenges that lie ahead. Let me say this at the outset today. It's often hard to talk about Rwanda. There are deeply and passionately held views about the country and the strategies and tactics of the current government and where the country may be going. There are two general narratives on Rwanda and where it's headed, one that emphasizes the country's growth, its stability after the horrific events of the 1990s, the competence of its leadership and strategic vision. I think there's another that is troubled by the lack of political competition, the government's seeming reluctance to open up to that. And what that might mean for Rwanda, perhaps not today or tomorrow, but down the line. It's been very hard to find common ground between these two narratives, and the kind of debate often disintegrates into ad hominem attacks, accusations of ill will, or ulterior motives. Ultimately, I think the challenge is to find a way for proponents on each side to debate and engage each other in civil discourse, acknowledge and accommodate that there may be legitimately held and well-intentionally held conflicting opinions, perspectives, and thoughts on the best way forward. A challenge in forums like this, and that's why I bring it up at the outset. But I think most important is a challenge for Rwandans themselves within Rwanda. I mean, that's the critical challenge of democratic debate, and how do you civilly discuss when there are legitimate and well-intentioned differences of opinion. So we're looking forward to discussion on this. I'm going to turn to Scott for about 20 minutes to say some word, to talk about the report. I've recently done a much more modest kind of 10-year outlook for Rwanda, which I'll say a few words about. Then we'll open it up from discussion. I do want to acknowledge Ambassador James Kimonyo from the Rwandan Embassy. Welcome, sir. Glad you're here, and we're looking forward to the discussion. Scott, why don't we open up to you, and then we'll open for general discourse.
to CSIS for hosting the event and to Farah Tahir, especially, who handled the logistics. I've long admired the work that CSIS has done, and so it's an honor for me to be here. I'm going to be discussing post-genocide Rwanda today, and the main impetus, as Jennifer said, is a book that was published earlier this year that I co-edited with Lars Waldorf called Remaking Rwanda, and I do indeed have a copy here. Like Jennifer, I just want to lay a couple cards out on the table before I start. As many of us in the room know, debates about contemporary Rwanda are often quite polarized and polarizing. They can become quite nasty. And the main conclusion of our book, which is clearly resonant with the report that CSIS did earlier this year, is that the Rwandan model of reconstruction is cause for concern. This is not to deny the impressive gains that have been made in the past 17 years, and to which I'll return, but it is to say that these impressive gains could be at risk if there are not significant gains in the realms of political freedom and human rights. Now, I don't want to make the presentation about me, but I just want to say that I've been working on Rwanda since, and traveling to Rwanda since the mid-1990s, and for myself and for most of the contributors in this book, I think the place where we're coming from is one of concern. It's one of concern about Rwanda's future. It's one of it's not one of mean-spiritedness. It's really about Rwanda's future and the future for Rwandans. So I hope that the conversation today and a real debate that Rwanda can generate can be about issues and not about personalities or individuals. So I've divided my presentation into five main parts. First, I'll discuss the origins of the book. Next, I'll discuss the book's contents. Then I'll present the main arguments and findings from the book. There are 26 chapters in the book, and so there are a lot of different voices, but I'll try to pull out some of the main cumulative findings from the book. Fourth, I'll present the two main normative perspectives on contemporary Rwanda, which Jennifer just referenced. The book falls into the latter camp, a kind of critical camp, and I'll explain why. And finally, I'll conclude with what I think are some of the main policy and even some of the more theoretical implications of the work. So the book came into being largely because of the tragic death of Alison DeForge in the Buffalo air crash of February 2009. For those of you who knew or knew of Alison, she certainly needs no introduction. For those of you who did not, she was a legendary figure in Rwandan and Great Lakes circles. Formerly, Alison was a senior advisor to Human Rights Watch. She was the author of a number of very influential reports, the most important of which is her documentation and analysis of the 1994 genocide, which helped her to earn a MacArthur Genius Award. She was a major figure at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, where she was, I think, the key expert witness in a number of trials. More informally, she mentored, I would say, two, maybe even three generations of scholars on Rwanda. She was the go-to person for journalists, diplomats, and lawyers and human rights activists. She was effectively the leading expert on Rwanda, and she was unabashed at speaking truth to power. So for those of us in the Rwandan studies community, as well as, of course, for her friends and family, her loss was monumental. Now, there were a number of tributes that were done around the world, as well, you know, including the United States. Lars Waldorf and I held two conferences in her honor. The first was in London, which Lars organized and which showcased a number of scholars from a new generation who recently had been to Rwanda and who Alison had influenced or mentored. And the second was in Madison, Wisconsin, which I co-hosted with Lars. And one of the striking themes, in addition to the grief that surfaced at both of these meetings, was a sense of a need to speak up in the wake of Alison's death. At that time especially, Rwanda enjoyed a very bright reputation in international policy circles, and the dominant discourse on Rwanda was of a model of successful, even extraordinary, reconstruction. Alison was one of the lone prominent critical voices, a position she developed, at least publicly, in my view, especially in the last 5 or 6 years before her death, and she paid for it. She was pilloried for her criticism. She was even denied entry at one point. While Alison was alive, many of us who worked on Rwanda practiced a form of self-censorship in the sense that knowing that any public criticism would be met very harshly and be met perhaps with the inability to return to the country, we often, or so we imagined, we often tamed our critiques and left it to Alison to be the effective, be more effective than any of us could be, but to be the one who really carried that torch. And so without Allison, many of us felt that the concerns that we shared had to come to the fore. So after these conferences, Lars and I gathered together a number of the papers, we invited a few others, and we decided to do a book. And from the beginning, the idea was to do a book in her honor and a book that reflected her priorities and her intellectual qualities. It reflected her priorities in the sense that it was explicitly critical of the regime, but also it reflected her intellectual qualities in marrying human rights work with deep scholarly knowledge, her attention to the marginalized, her commitment to field work, and her keen sense of history. Now let me turn to the book itself. There are 26 chapters and 29 authors. which is a lot of work to put together. After some introductory materials, there are five main substantive sections. The first is on governance and state building. The second is on regional and donor relations. The third is on justice. The fourth is on rural development. And the fifth is on memory. There are also two afterwards, one by Joseph Seberenzi and the other by Alois Habimana. Now, the specific chapters are wide-ranging. I won't cover all of them. They include an analysis of the nature of political competition, or the absence of it, relations between civil society and the state, manipulations of the genocide ideology law, local governance, policy towards children in contemporary Rwanda, Rwanda's actions in the Congo and impunity for those actions, different justice mechanisms from the ICTR to Gacaca, land law reform, villagization, genocide memorialization, education reform, and finally an eyewitness account of Ingando, which is a re-education camp system in the country. There are a mix of veteran scholars, such as David Newberry, Kathy Newberry, and Philip Renchens. There are a number of new scholars who the book actually showcases, such as Bert Ingeleri, Eugenia Zorbas, Susan Thompson, Kirilli Pels, Lindsay Hilker, Jason Stearns, Federico Borello, Mats Rettig, and others. And then there are a number of more mid-career scholars like myself, Lars Waldorf, and Tim Longman, who've been working on Rwanda and writing about Rwanda for about a decade or so, and a couple of practitioners. The chapters tend to be short. They are mainly descriptively analytical rather than being theoretically oriented, and they're meant to be accessible. While there have been a number of good books on post-genocide Rwanda, we believe that Remaking Rwanda is the first to look at the country in a somewhat comprehensively, and not completely comprehensively, and critically way, rather than being focused on a particular sector like the justice sector or a particular individual such as President Kagame. Now, what are the main arguments? Now, again, there are 26 chapters, 29 authors, so there's a range of voices in the volume, but let me highlight a few points that we emphasized in the introduction. The essential characterization of the ruling RPF's governing ideology that emerges from the book is what we call transformative authoritarianism. While there are differences of views within the influential ruling elite in the ruling party, there is a general consensus about the broad outlines of its governing philosophy, and the label that we put on that is transformative authoritarianism. Now, why authoritarian? First, there is a strong belief that the state should exercise control over the political and even the social realm. In effect, the governing philosophy of the regime allows for a narrow band of political and social discourse, one that tolerates almost no public criticism of government and one that expects conformity on government-set historical policy and social narratives. Where the regime encounters deviations from that narrow band of discourse, it will actively challenge and undermine the authors of that deviation. The control extends most clearly to the political arena, where key opponents to the regime are not allowed to contest elections in an open fashion, and where those who directly threaten the regime are sometimes assassinated, or threatened to be assassinated. The control extends into independent civil society, in particular over the media, where articles perceived as critical result in newspaper suspension or other forms of intimidation, or over non-governmental organizations which are expected not to assert any sort of critical challenges to the regime. The control also extends over citizen public discourse, where references to ethnicity or the raising of alternative viewpoints is generally met with severe negativity and intimidation. In my view, one can only characterize the political and even public atmosphere as repressive, as authoritarian, and the net impact for many Rwandans, in particular for those who would like to be critical, is the experience of intimidation and fear of dissent. This is not a secret. If you look at any of the quantitative indicators of democracy and freedom, Rwanda ranks very poorly. In the most recent Freedom House rankings, Rwanda received a not free combined score, putting it in the company of Gabon and Congo-Brazzaville, and with the only African states to do worse being Sudan, Zimbabwe, Eritrea, Chad, Cameroon, Ethiopia, the DRC, and Cote d'Ivoire, but the latter for exceptional reasons. In the most recent Press Freedom Index from Reporters Without Borders, Rwanda received a ranking of 169th, if I'm not mistaken, i.e. one of the 10 worst countries in the world, with only Sudan and Eritrea scoring worse in Africa. And contrary to some naive expectations, the political environment is not improving over time. We are not seeing a trend toward political liberalization. In fact, I would say most recently the tilt is in the other direction. To be sure, there have been and will be movements around the mean, depending on particular circumstances, but strong coercive social and political control is the mean. It is a central part of the regime's governing philosophy, one that is tied to a particular interpretation of Rwandan society and history. Second, in addition to the political and social realm, one cannot ignore the importance of military control in the regime's outlook. The military is the key structural base of power in the country, and from President Kagame on down, control of the army in particular is of central importance. So I think we have to characterize the regime's philosophy and practice as authoritarian. Now, why transformative? Okay. In effect, while holding the political realm constant, the philosophy, in our view, is to reconstruct the economy and society. One can see this clearly with ethnicity, where references to Hutu and Tutsi are generally publicly forbidden. One can see this with redoing geographical markers, which were reorganized and renamed since the RPF took power. One can see this with formal efforts at citizen re-education, including Ingando and Iterero. One can see this with economic reform, in particular the move to find alternative to smallholder agriculture through information technology and other means. One can see this with some non-political aspects of governance, including an emphasis on taxation, accountability, transparency, and service delivery. One can see this in regard to Congo, where the RPF recast the rules of the game for security. And one can see this with language politics, in particular the changing of official language. And there are other domains too. In short, I think we are dealing here with a vision of deep social reengineering, what I would shorthand as transformation, hence transformative authoritarianism. Now, let me add a couple other points that come out in the book across the chapters. One is that the regime tends to instrumentalize the memory of genocide and seeks to control how the memory of the genocide is constructed. Certainly, one can see this with the genocide ideology law, which has been used to silence critics. And to my mind, this is a very dangerous game. Another theme is how the donor community, the United States and the United Kingdom in particular, but also the World Bank and others, have been central actors and supporters of the regime and that make its survival possible. Here, a common theme that comes out in the book is that of what some authors call the genocide credit, where the idea of the history of the genocide is used as a way of blunting criticism from donors. Finally, the book documents the key roles that Rwanda played in the Congo Wars, emphasizing a pattern of impunity for crimes committed there, and argues, though central to the argument, is that Congo must be part of any assessment of post-genocide Rwanda. Now, before I get to an assessment, which is where I think the controversy lies, let me just briefly reference a couple arguments in the book about why this model of transformative authoritarianism exists in the first place. And here, let me just flag a couple of factors. I think, first, the regime, at least when it came to power, and I would argue this is still the case, has a fairly narrow base of political support. The core base of support are Anglophone Tutsis, which is an increasingly narrow band of support given defections within that group. And thus, I think the decision was transformation and repression were better alternatives to open competition. Second, there is the history of the genocide, and in particular, a particular interpretation of the genocide. And in effect, that interpretation holds that society and politics that preceded 1994, Rwandan society, led to the genocide, and therefore transformation and control of that society were both justified. There are a couple other contributing factors, I think, including the pathway to power. The RPF won a military victory and therefore owed nothing to anyone in the sense of a domestic constituency or international force. Another factor is the military background and political education of many of the influential leaders in the regime. And finally, I think the institutional characteristics of the Rwandan state, which is historically, back to pre-colonial times, has been hardwired for social control. Okay. Now, I think there probably is some degree of agreement on the points that I've just made. But I think the real disagreement, the real controversy, lies in how to evaluate this decision and this model of transformative authoritarianism. And I think as one gets it into that question, is this model good for Rwanda or not? I think one cannot underestimate the challenges and difficulty of governing a post-war, post-genocide, income-poor country like Rwanda. This is not, you know, I say to my students, this is not Madison, Wisconsin after the Walker protests. You know, this was a very difficult place to govern. In any case, there are clearly two camps that have developed. On the one hand, there's a very positive view, one that has earned Rwanda and President Kagame in particular a great deal of accolade. And in that vein, let me point to what I consider to be some real accomplishments. First, one cannot underestimate the importance of stabilization and a sense of security. This was achieved through a number of means, including military aggression in the Congo, repression at home, and a justice system that contributed to a sense of intimidation. Nonetheless, the security situation is real. When I first started going to Rwanda in 1995 and 1996, I traveled in armed convoys. That's totally unimaginable today. Second, one has to admire the economic gains. During the past decade, Rwanda has had an average economic growth of 8% per annum. Kigali is a very different place today than it was in the mid-1990s. Again, we can raise questions about this, including growing inequality between urban and rural spaces, as well as the growth that came from exploitation in the Congo, but still the growth is real. Third, there have been significant gains in non-political aspects of governance. The amount of visible corruption is low. There is a formal commitment to the rule of law. Tax collection has grown significantly. And Rwanda ranks the highest among East African states in terms of the World Bank's indicators of doing business. There are other things to say, but let me add one more. And Jennifer referenced this as well. There is a visionary, can-do, intelligent leadership in Rwanda. Rwandan leaders from President Kagame on down are articulate. They are confident, smart, and charismatic. They are tremendous military tacticians. There is a lot to admire there. And when I first met many of the leaders, I was wowed when in the 90s and the 2000s, etc. So what are the negatives? I think in general terms, the big concern, the big message, is that without a change in the political realm, many of the gains that have been registered in the other realms are going to be fragile. We know from Rwandan history that stability, order, growth, and being a donor favorite are not guarantees against political violence. We also know that repression means that a range of voices in Rwanda is simply not being heard. There is, I think, serious political exclusion. Repression also means that many ordinary people are too intimidated to speak out and that a good deal of talent has fled the country. Although I have only impressionistic data, I believe that de facto ethnic inequality and urban-rural inequality are both growing. All of these things, as well as impunity for RPF crimes in Rwanda and in Congo, have created a serious reserve of alienation, a great deal of ill will toward the regime, and I'm afraid growing genocide denialism. And these critical voices are growing. They are growing especially outside the country in the diaspora. And all of that causes me and a number of the contributors great concern for Rwanda's future. On the one hand, there are clear positives, and one can go to Rwanda and you can clearly see a number of things that are going well. But on the other hand, from where I sit, the negative views of the regime are growing, and unless there is a greater openness and accommodation, I believe that those voices will only intensify over time. By way of conclusion, let me offer a couple general and some specific points, and here I'll be brief in the interest of time, and obviously there's much more to say. At stake here, I think, is clearly Rwanda and Rwanda's future, and this matters primarily for Rwandans. Almost every Rwandan I've ever met wants to do everything possible to avoid the terrible past that they have lived through or that they know their parents lived through. So that's clearly what I think at stake. That's what this is really all about. Secondarily, I think that from where I sit, the memory of the genocide is also at stake, which is very important to survivors. And I think there, from a policy perspective, there are concerns about how stable this model of transformative authoritarianism is, which in turn has implications for regional stability. I think there's a more theoretical implication, which is probably not necessarily the main concern in this audience, but that concerns a model of post-conflict governance. Rwanda has, over the years, been held up as a model for other states that are recovering from armed conflict and atrocities. And I think the question here is, should it be a model for other countries? How important are political liberty and human rights for post-conflict recovery? Third, I think, is a more, even more general sense of model of development. The choice in Rwanda has been one of technocratic governance, of economic growth, service delivery, and stability, but without political rights. Is this the model for developing countries, for transitioning countries? What are the advantages and disadvantages of that model? Now, I obviously put my cards on the table. The book is coming from a place of concern about what the future portends for Rwanda unless a change is made. And I do believe there is time to change, unlike some of my colleagues. But I hope this can be a debate. It can be a debate about the strengths and weaknesses of this model. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks very much, Scott. I'm just going to say briefly a word or two about our recent report on Rwanda stress testing. This was part of a series that was commissioned to us to look at 10 countries, most of which were ostensibly stable. I mean, Sudan was thrown in there, but that was somewhat of the exception. To say, kind of, what are we missing in these countries that 5, 10 years down the line may then come back and surprise us in terms of vulnerabilities? What are some of the structural vulnerabilities? What are the potential triggers? And what are the kind of trend lines that we need to be watching on these? So we took a look at 10 countries. I can list them, but we had Senegal, Ghana, Angola, Botswana, Rwanda, Kenya, Uganda, Ethiopia, Sudan, North and South, Nigeria, countries all of which are in some way important to the United States, for one, as a partner, and most of which, David Throop, who is here, did Ghana and Botswana, are really, conventional wisdom has it that they are quite stable. And I think to a certain extent, people think the same about Rwanda, Ethiopia. People are more concerned about some of the more volatile states, Kenya after the election crisis, for example, or Nigeria and so forth. But we were tasked with kind of looking a little harder, challenging some of the conventional wisdom, and admittedly, it's stress testing. It's not what is going all right in these countries and reassure us that we're okay. It's saying what really vulnerabilities may go wrong. Interestingly, and I'll just say I'll get a little bit specific about Rwanda, and I'm really going to talk very briefly on this, but three of the countries in this study that were really of most concern to us were Ethiopia, Uganda, and Rwanda. all three of which, well, Sudan was on a level of its own, let me think, so that was kind of off the charts. But all three of those countries coming out of conflict, charismatic leadership who came in, militarily brilliant, established stability, won a huge credit of legitimacy for reestablishing stability in places that had seen such devastating levels of violence, none as much as Rwanda, obviously, but all three kind of all three horrific in their own ways. And important partners of the United States, these were all the new leaders that President Clinton spoke about. There's a lot of hope for these countries. It was kind of a turning point, an end to some of these really brutal, gruesome conflicts in Africa. But I think over time, there's been the challenge of how do you shift your legitimacy from one of simply restoring stability and that which is obviously very important, to a broader political legitimacy that, in the longer term, as you move away from those conflicts and the memory of the conflict, becomes more important. So, I think for us, in none of those three countries, do you really see a momentum towards greater political openness? All three, I mean, Ethiopia on a national level at least is stable and it's holding. Obviously, there's the Ogaden to worry about. We did see kind of riots in Uganda, but that was a real surprise, I think, for many people. But these countries are among the least volatile, let's say, of the countries that we looked at, and yet they're the kind of the most worrisome, I think, because how they eventually do open up, whether it's by choice of the leadership or otherwise, is a big question, and it may ultimately break in kind of ways that are difficult to predict and risky and possibly violent. We're not predicting that, but the uncertainty is there. I think towards the end of this study, we were, you know, the stories from Libya and Tunisia were coming forward, which said, look, you know, you have to look at some of these countries that we do take their stability for granted over time. And if they're unable to react to volatility and political competition, ultimately they can break in very unpredictable ways. I don't want to repeat too much of what Scott said. I think, in some ways, my findings, which were informed by many people who have done a lot more and a lot longer on Rwanda than I. But I went to Rwanda, I think, with what I hoped was an open mind. I knew the two competing narratives. I have a general bias towards the idea that political competition is inevitable. Personal and political ambition, it's just human nature. No matter how much economic growth and stability and development you do have, it's within human nature, and I think that's universal, whether it's Rwandans, Americans, or whatever bent. And I guess the biggest finding to me and the biggest vulnerability down the line is how the RPF government is going to manage that. And whether it's not doing things now that make it ultimately more difficult to open up. And I'd like to maybe turn to Scott as the first question eventually and say, you know, how would you do this in the end? Has the Rwandan government, in a way, backed itself down into a corner where it has this a vision of social engineering and social transformation that sounds theoretically well, sounds theoretically sound on paper in a way, although if you look at case after case, rarely are those kinds of top-down national social engineering strategies, do they really ultimately work? I was a huge fan of Nyerere in college, still am, but, there was a certain... There was certain intellectual arrogance to Nyerere that thought, you know, you can really do this if you just control it enough and if you just can make it happen. And you just can't, because human nature is just not that way. So in terms of you know, it's very difficult for as a short-term visitor to Rwanda to really get a full sense of the country. I think, as you said, people are quite quiet about their views. It's hard to interview average Rwandans, whatever that may mean, as a short-term visitor. And so I think many of the takeaways were from conversations with government officials. I think in terms of vulnerabilities, what I outlined were social divisions that remain. Again, it's hard to get what ordinary Rwandans think, but every conversation with a government official that I had on kind of where is the country going began with, well, you have to start in 1994, and then proceeded to discuss the sensitivities and the fragilities that Rwanda is still trying to grapple with. An acknowledgement that, you know, the fairly stringent limits on speech, on political competition are required, lest we go back to that polarization of the 90s and before. And the fear that even limited polemical rhetoric may quickly and massively revive social divisions. You hear kind of the rural populations, they're not that well educated, they can't necessarily make the distinctions between what's true and what's not. And so there's the possibility for very rapid mobilization stirred up by that kind of rhetoric, which says to me that that kind of rhetoric will resonate in some way with populations. And I think speaks a little bit to the fact that social divisions clearly are still a vulnerability. Second, the brittle nature and the fragility of the RPF government. I think the RPF is clearly aware of its fragility in some ways. In the suppression of dissent and critique, sometimes the responses to criticism from kind of analysts, think tankers, academics, is kind of astounding to me. It almost takes you aback. And it says, well, if for some foreign researcher like me, if the response is so vitriolic, what might that mean for a critique of the regime who might live within Rwanda? And I asked, you know, is there any outspoken critic of the RPF within the country that I might, you know, be able to talk to who's living in Kigali? And I think there isn't, really. I think every outspoken critic of the RPF government is either in prison, is either dead, or is living outside of the country. And that's very troubling in terms of the future for stability of the country. I think the system relies on people who are committed to the process and willing to sacrifice, to a certain extent, personal ambition. I think I talked to one senior government official who said, you know, people that don't share that vision really just have no place in today's Rwanda. I mean, there is this this kind of very thorough commitment to the vision that you talked about. You hear kind of almost the same phrases again and again from senior political leadership. And really, where is the room to challenge that from even within? And when you ask about critics who have left the country, some of whom were, I think, eager to make this work, some of whom were in the coalition early on, some of whom were survivors themselves, some of whom were RPF adherents and loyalists to Kagame himself, universally they are dismissed as either corrupt, personally ambitious, or seeking to foment division. And that's troubling to me as well. The third vulnerability are the limits, I think, to the development without competitive politics model. And again, this goes back to the idea that political ambition is inevitable, and almost more so when the stakes get higher and the economy is growing. I think demands for political change will likely outstrip the stabilizing or conciliating effects of economic growth. Benefits of economic growth take some time to be felt by all Rwandan citizens. I think in Kenya, you see growth, but unequal growth has a very destabilizing effect, ultimately. Some of the big money contracts, and I talked to a few people about this, you know, may actually increase political competition among political elites. And there's some accusations that the RPF and the RPA have kind of inordinate links into these big money sectors like aviation, banking, construction, telecommunications. So again, I'll finish with, you know, the government, to my mind, is somewhat backing itself into a corner. And how do you begin to reverse that? Repression of dissent breeds increased resentment and criticism that imperils the RPF, which then feels more vulnerable and responds through even greater levels of repression. And that makes opening up political space even more difficult to countenance. In the report, you know, I think ultimately, if the RPF chooses to begin that process of beginning to open it, has to begin with some of the national institutions. I think there was a chance in the late 1990s to really establish the legislature as kind of a genuinely representative check to the executive. A chance. I mean, it was quickly suppressed. But I mean, that kind of an independent national body, I think, is something we need to start with. And the judiciary. If there's any way to do that, how do you find a judiciary, that independent judiciary, that kind of can adjudicate the disputes in a fairly independent way? These things are very hard to see happening right now. It's a kind of a tautological system, and I'll be interested to hear from Scott and perhaps some of those here what the best opportunities for beginning to open that up are. Anyway, I'll stop at that, and let's open up to questions. Maybe you want to tackle that first one about where might the opportunities lie, and we can.
Okay, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a very good question, and I don't have the answer to the question. If I was asked to how would one do it, I would say it should be gradual but firm. I don't think that there is a model. I mean, in the political science literature of so-called transitology, I don't think that there is a model of successful transitions from authoritarian systems to more democratic ones that you can just sort of pull off the shelf and drop into Rwanda or somewhere else, and I don't think that would necessarily be right. If there was, I'm not sure that conditions in Rwanda would favor that. I mean, clearly there has to be more space for debate. There clearly has to be more space for accountability on all sides of various acts of violence. Clearly there have to be construction of national institutions that can decenter power and that can structure competition and that can foster new ideas. I think questions of succession, questions of internal debates within the ruling party, all should be more transparent. You know, I don't think you just have elections in Rwanda. That's my view. But I think you should build up towards more. I'm not saying that elections are bad. I'm just saying that I don't think you can just all of a sudden open the political space to a sudden competition, as was the case in 1992. I'm not sure that that's the right model for the country. But I don't have the answer. I don't know what the recipe is. Yeah.
Let's open up. We'll go to the gentleman here, then to me, and then to John. And we'll take three at a time and then come back.
Sounds good.
You can introduce yourself as well.
Yeah, my name is Ferdinand. I stay here in Washington, D.C. Thank you, Jenny, for having put it that there are two competing camps, actually, when dealing with the question of Rwanda. And Scott recognized that even himself and the book they have written is actually in a critical camp, the government of Rwanda. It is good to recognize that so that people have a kind of basis to discussion. You know what you are discussing about. I have actually read the book, which is actually, I completed the book, I think, 2 months ago, when it was just coming out of the printer. I realized that the book is a collection of articles written by a group of people who have, all of them are critical of the government of Rwanda. And the good thing of it is that it highlights challenges. Which challenges? I admit that the Rwandan government, of course, it has challenges. Taking into account where it came from 17 years ago, it would really be unfair to compare Rwanda like Ghana which have never known genocide. And those challenges, most of you, you have admitted that there are some progress that are seen on the ground when you go to Rwanda. Scott himself recognized that he went there in 1995. And I don't know who said that he was under heavy escort by then. But now, if you go to Rwanda, security and stability is well maintained, and you see it by your own eyes. Without even doing any further research, you see that stability, that peace that is prevailing in the country now. To arrive at that juncture, I believe, the government of Rwanda have initiated some homegrown initiatives. And these homegrown initiatives really have yielded into peace and the stability that you are enjoying today. And if, for example, in the book I saw that you are criticizing most of these homegrown initiatives, and the question that Jenny had just asked you, if you have any predicament for those challenges in Rwanda, you said that you have none. It's good to do a research, but after at the end of the day, you come up with a solution. So actually, so many people, even since 1994, I have been reading a book on my country. I'm concerned because it is my own country. You, for example, you are doing it as a researcher, but you don't have that passion of being your own country. Me, it is my own country, and I feel it, and I see it, and I see what is written. I have been reading since 1994, and I have seen so many prophecies that are predicting doom for my country in the future. We have now gone 17 years down the road, and actually what we are seeing is peace and stability. So I wonder if really this book, Remaking Rwanda, you have just produced, has a certain benefit for the Rwandan people, or if it is just like confusing the Rwandans. Because yes, we have challenges, we have to overcome them, we have come up with homegrown initiatives, we are on the road, we are counting 1, 2, 3, we are not yet at 10. So why do you really put like a, this is like, I don't know how to clarify it. Look, it's up to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Jennifer. My name is Nia Akwete. I belong to a coalition called the Africa Great Lakes Coalition here, and we focus on the Great Lakes. But the question, I want to direct my question to U.S. relationship, especially given that this is happening in Washington, and hopefully policymakers will hear it. And Jennifer, the three countries that came from the stress test project. If, as you mentioned, they are all close U.S. partners. And so what I'm looking at is, you know, this to me continues a long tradition of close U.S. relationship with African dictators. It goes back to the time of the Cold War when we were given reasons for that, but it continued under President Clinton. It's continuing now. That's the backdrop of my question, which I'm directing at Dr. Strauss. You said that among the authors and other researchers, there has been growing concern about what's going on in Rwanda. So my question is, do you sense some of that concern within the U.S. policy community too? Are they also beginning to say, hey, wait a minute, I mean, the same kind of thoughts going through the minds of the experts, is it also in the policy corridors, and can you sense any kind of, hey, maybe we ought to review Washington's relationship with Kigali? Thank you.
John Harbison from SAIS. You won't be surprised, I see some obvious parallels to Ethiopia in what you said. In fact, I think I could write the same book about Ethiopia, very simply. But I guess I want to put Jennifer's question to you again. I mean, how do you walk back? The Ethiopians sort of walked back, and then they got scared, and they clamped down because it is brittle, and they know it's brittle. So, and in the case of Ethiopia, the very fabric of the state, I think, is an issue. How do you walk back without losing the state itself. And so I guess I want to put Jennifer's question to you again.
We can, I think they can, I can address them relatively quickly. Ferdinand, thank you for your comments. You know, I'm going to pass on the question as whether or not the book is just confusing Rwandans. You know, it's the nature of scholarly debate to put ideas on the table. They should be empirically founded. They should be reasonable. They should not be overly polemical. I think we've done that in the book. The book is clearly not balanced. We are not structuring a debate in the book. We were operating from a position that at the time when we were putting together the chapters, that the dominant discourse on the Rwanda was very, very positive. And so we were trying what we considered sort of balancing out an already existing debate, but the book itself is not trying to structure pro and anti position. It is there are a range of voices. Not everyone would agree with what I've said here, and people have different views in the book. But most of us are concerned and are critical, and I think that's, you know, it's a criticism of the book, but it's a criticism that I don't think dooms its contribution. And just to clarify, I said, and I'll guess I'll come back to this with John, it's not that I have no solutions for Rwanda. I don't know exactly what the model is to transition from a highly authoritarian system to a more democratic system. I don't think there is one recipe to do that, but I'll try again here. With Nyakwete's question, I don't have private knowledge, but I have the impressionistic sense that that there is growing concern within policymaking communities. I don't know where that will go. I don't know how deep it is. I think it's happening in Britain. I think the flap over the fears of assassination of political dissidents in Britain was a wake-up call for a number of political actors in Britain. That's my sense from across the pond. I have the sense that the way in which the elections unfolded last year became was just too raw to people in Washington. I think had to have pause, and some of the statistics on political indicators that I cited to you earlier suggest, I think, that there is cause for concern. But I don't know. I don't know if there's going to be a policy change. So John's question, I mean, I guess, and I suspect, frankly, other people are better placed than I am. I mean, I'm outside of Washington. So how do you walk back? I mean, I guess I want to reiterate what I said. I don't have a better answer. Gradual but firm, meaning you can't do it all of a sudden as one fell swoop, but it has to be firm. You have to do it. I think there first has to be some type of space for more open discussion. That can be through, you know, even if the perception is that people, journalists are irresponsible, you let them publish. Maybe you put certain boundaries on that in terms of inciting hatred, but you be serious about when you're talking about inciting of hatred. I think have to decenter power through institutions. You have to have a parliament that has some real power, where there are competing parties that are real differences of views that are allowed to operate in parliament. There has to be some accountability for past crimes on the part of the RPF. I think the issues of secession, all those things are real. And I think eventually you can have more open political competition and elections. But I think it should be gradual but firm. But as I said earlier, there's a risk here. This is a place that we know from its history. There are real risks. It's not Ghana. And you don't have to look far to see how nasty outside the country. I mean, this is the concern. Outside the country, the debate is very, very nasty. Not talking about people like me. I'm talking about other Rwandans in the diaspora. And we don't know what it's like inside the country because you don't know. And that's that. I think there has to be some outlet for that, because otherwise, I think it will grow. But I don't have a model. I don't have a recipe. And it's a good question. I don't deny it's a good question. I haven't probably thought about it enough. That's not exactly what I study. So yeah.
Ethiopia, Uganda, those kinds of places where the U.S. has a fairly strong security relationship. I mean, Ethiopia is one of our most important partners at this point. Rwanda, to a lesser degree, although they are big contributors to peacekeeping and they're very competent soldiers in those peacekeeping missions. But one question is the lack of leverage that we have on these countries. It's not the U.S. that is going to determine what happens within Rwanda or Ethiopia politically. We have very little leverage on that. In some ways, we need them for a security partnership, for example. And we're not going to most likely, pull some of the assistance that we give them do we want to punish Rwandan citizens in terms of, our health assistance, for example, and so forth, because we're having issues with our government. So that's the one tool we have right now. And so how to do that in an ethical way, too, is a very difficult one. I think in these countries, we need to be very clear, the government needs to be very clear in its rhetoric about what the nature of the relationship is. If in Ethiopia, it's we have a strong security relationship. We have a lot invested in their health system for Ethiopians and food and so forth. But that security relationship does not mean an embrace of the government's values and vision, and I think we have to be pretty clear about that in these kinds of partnerships. I think we need to depersonalize these relationships a great deal. I think that the whole new leaders of Africa thing was just a disaster, and I think we think we've gotten beyond that, but in fact that mentality still exists, and you have Kagame praised as kind of a model leadership in terms of some of the things he's doing, acknowledged that some of the things he's doing, but even if he were doing those things, I think we need to move away from the idea of embracing leaders for things we think they do right and wrong, and looking, giving more scrutiny to institutions and behavior rather than personalities. Finally, is to try to engage with a much broader swath of those countries than with their government, and so that people who are not in the favored side of whichever government have some kind of conversation with the United States. We can understand them. They have some outlet, and they're not feeling insulated and isolated within their own countries. I think. In some ways, some of the overblown rhetoric of praise in Rwanda has made that difficult for Rwandans to come to the United, to the embassy or to the U.S. government and talk kind of frankly about some of their concerns, because there's a little bit of groupthink going on with "yes, we can" on Rwanda, and I think and it's hard to say, wait a second, I'm very unhappy with this when even the U.S. government is kind of out front, I think. The leadership is aware of some of these conundrums. It's how now does that translate in some of the rhetoric and some of the action and how we explain these both to citizens in those countries and to the U.S. public. So let's take another round. Ambassador, and if you could use your mic.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. It's very difficult in a situation where you're listening to some allegations that are debatable. Each item that Scott presented here is subject to debate, serious and critical debate. But I think looking at the time that is allocated for this session, we're going to make statements and go, and for the benefit of the audience, I would probably suggest to break some of these issues into sub-themes and we have a comprehensive discussion in the future. Because I thank Scott and his team for, first of all, acknowledging what has happened in Rwanda since 1994 in terms of rebuilding Rwanda and the progress that we have registered over the period of 17 years, despite the challenges that we faced in the aftermath of genocide. I also understand that in their book, they clearly say that they're trying to provide a comprehensive critique of state reconstruction and looking into the peace building and human rights issues, and that they raise concerns about the durability of that process of building Rwanda, and they suggest some solutions which should be adopted to have a stable state and leave aside what they call rosy picture of today's Rwanda. But let me say that I have been to different events and meetings where people speak about Rwanda. I probably should say this is the smallest that I have attended. I have seen new faces here, young people who maybe have not been to Rwanda. If you go to some of these sessions, you will learn a lot about the case of Rwanda. It's a very unique case, a case of a country that has been ruled and has been under chronic bad leadership, a country that went through the worst kind of human catastrophe in the recent history, and a country that has been able in a very short period of time to be a competitive state. So it's a very important and interesting case study for scholars and people trying to understand the political science, especially in the contemporary world. I don't want to share the good news from Rwanda, but you all know that there's not a single state in sub-Saharan Africa that can compete with Rwanda in anything, doing business, MDGs, security within our cities, and so on. I don't want to spend much time there. How much I've seen in the cover page of the book is a group of students, and in front of them you have a military guy with a Kalashnikov. Maybe another person will print a book with a cover page whose picture would be, small kids holding their laptops, right? So that's maybe one of 100 things that, one of 100 pictures that this group picked. Now, let me say one thing, Dr. Scott and others. You are missing a very important element when you're trying to approach or deal with the case of Rwanda. A very important element that you're missing is the fact that building any political system is a process, right? So if you were here trying to tell the audience where Rwanda was 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 17 years ago, and where we are today, then we shall be measuring each single aspect of political process and say whether we've made any progress or not. If I took the case of the United States 50 years ago, there are many things that we can discuss, me and you, about your political system here. The situation that was prevailing in this country 50 years ago is completely, totally different from what we have today. Being what it is today, United States went through a lot, and we have been able to achieve what we have achieved because you went through a very hard process to be who you are today. If I look at Rwanda in 1994 and where we are today, in any aspect, that's why I said we can debate in any aspect, political, economical, justice, security, I can show you key milestones in each aspect of our political process and show you what we have achieved, when, and the nature of the achievements that we have made during that period. We can debate that. So if you miss that point and say, oh, if we go to Rwanda today, there is no open discussion like what you saw on Fox News and other channels. Well, maybe 5-10 years down the road, you'll see the same. You are missing that element. And I understand where you come from, because the obsession of some aspects of your political system and your culture is what has interfered with African political system. When Belgians came to Rwanda in 1900, they had been obsessed by the issues of race between Flamers and Walos. So when they came to Rwanda, they had that obsession. If I take the case of Professor Scott and others, who, for them, when they were born, they found a very strong political system, open debate, talking about this and that, and they feel like that should be happening everywhere in the world, I think you are getting it wrong. It is important to contribute to the fact that people are striving to get to the point where you have a stable and promising political system. We are not saying we have to go through all those hurdles that went through, the assassinations and other things that happened in the process of building a political system. But we are saying we can leapfrog some of the steps that, because of the technology and other innovations, we can be able to reach a certain point where Rwanda can say it has a very mature, complete political space or political maturity, depending on how you define it. But there is another important element that we are missing. Any political system is built on the basis of historical context, one, two, on ethics of each society, three, on traditional values embedded in their culture. See, you criticize Itorero as being a program to train militias. Go and read the history of Rwanda even before the king. That Itorero is something that was meant to teach people, to train Rwandans about their values, about what they should be in terms of being useful citizens in their country. If you talk about Ingando, Gachacha, and many other innovative ideas that came after 1994 are all based on our culture and traditional values. If you miss the historical context of our country, for instance, the issues of ethnicity, the way you want it to be handled, for instance, you say you can't say discuss anything about Hutus publicly in Rwanda because you are going to be put into prison because of the divisions, whatever law that is in place. Well, I have been here, arrived here in 2007 during the time when the campaign was starting until when President Obama was elected. I followed it very closely and I had a keen interest to know how the debate takes place. The debate on any electoral process in the U.S. is around issues, policy issues, education, immigration, security, social security, and nothing about race. If someone spoke something, even insinuating something about race, I'm talking about the past elections, be it the candidate, a journalist, or the supporter, they would go back the next day to say, you know what? I didn't mean to offend anybody. I meant A, B, C, D. A country that has enjoyed freedoms and liberty for more than 200 years goes back to apologize because someone said something closer to meaning race discrimination. But in Rwanda, because we know the history of genocide, ethnicity card was played to commit genocide. And we are saying, wait a minute, even in our constitution, I debate these things, I address people all the time, and I talk about Hutus and Tutsis. I have never faced any problem or anybody whenever you use Hutu Tutsi in a constructive way. But if you use it in a divisive manner, then you have to face the law. Why do you think Americans are afraid to, during the campaign process, especially the political leaders? They are very careful and they're very sensitive about race issues. I can give you examples, and you know the examples during the election, the previous elections here in this country. So if you miss that point, that, oh, superficially you say, oh, Rwandans don't debate about ethnicity, they do. But if you debate it in a manner that is going to divide the society, then you have caught up with the law. Why don't we discuss these things in its proper context? Because if you take it out of context, then you are confusing especially the young people. And I challenge everybody in this room to take your time, take trouble to go and Rwanda. I was in Rwanda from 9th of July until 10th of September. I'm a Rwandan, but I have to confess that I had not listened to local radios that use our local vernacular, Kinyarwanda. People talk about the lack of debate in Rwanda. I was surprised myself because I thought, well, we do the debates in our national retreat and the parliament and so on. I did not know that actually our rural populations have been empowered to question the government on the whole spectrum of issues, from political to economic. The other day, I was in a gym at about 10, and I heard people raising questions against the government leaders. What they have not delivered, what they promised to do, and they have not done it through the radio, public radio, and they say their names and where they come from. There is a debate going on. But the way one is displayed in this meeting, another meeting, it's as if it's a very police state. You cannot say anything. I cannot interview anybody. Jennifer, I challenge you. I want to go with you. And maybe stay somewhere in a car, and you go and interview anybody in that country, and they will tell you what they feel about their country and the future of Rwanda. The only problem is that there is a preconceived kind of perception that when you go to Rwanda, you want to hear someone saying, we don't want Kagame, we don't want the RPF, we don't want this. But people have made their choices. I was born and grew up in Tanzania myself, right? I was trained as a civil engineer, okay? And when I was being trained, I thought, my future is going to be based on what I will do in my life as a civil engineer. And I have the capability, and I believe it is the same way to my colleagues, the capability of choosing between good and bad. I'm part of the government. We know we cannot uphold a system or build a system that in the end is going to be to grow into, maybe, how should I say it, make us slide back into what we went through. If that was the choice, I would simply go anywhere and work as an engineer. But because I believe in what we do, because I believe that we have the capabilities intellectually to think about the future and forge and decide and determine our destiny, that's why I'm talking what I'm talking about. Sometimes there is this mentality, and sorry to say, not made for Scott or others, the mentality of mastery and the mentality of subjugation. That these are Africans, they don't know what's democracy, we have to teach them. We know. We have gone through this and we know what we did. So please engage us. Let's discuss all those issues in details. Let's go to the ground and determine what Rwandans are doing in a much more objective way. Otherwise, presenting what you're presenting here, people may even get afraid to buy a ticket to go to Rwanda. Whereas when you talk to students from Harvard, from New York University, from Chicago, from everywhere, they tell you, when I go to Rwanda, it's the only place on the continent where I can go and dance until 4 a.m. And nobody will snatch my watch or my bag. So it is contrary to what these people are presenting. Please, let's be objective. And you see, it's like having children in your house and you keep on saying you are bad, you are wrong, you fight, you are nothing, you don't perform well in school. You haunt, you torment that kid. In the end, this kid is going to get confused. Mm. Fortunately, we have a stable leader. Fortunately, we have gone through so much, so we know what it means by having external interference. Otherwise, with this kind of accusations from left and right, we would be confused and maybe take some strange decisions. But we are very stable, and we remain focused on transforming our country, and we want to make it a better place for our people and for the entire humanity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ambassador. Do you want to respond, should we?
I'm happy to keep going.
Okay, yeah. Okay. A gentleman here, and then lady, and then Throop.
Yeah, I want to thank you. My name is Bosco Munga. I want to thank you for this panel. And I also just want to thank everybody for not making this a particular instrument to hit on anybody, but rather to share ideas about what may be best for Rwanda in different ways. And I'd like to contribute towards the question, Jennifer, you asked. Where do we go from here? What is it that we can move in terms of moving from greater stability? It is important that you acknowledge the stability that happens to be there in Rwanda today. And it's also very important to also acknowledge, as you say, that it is possible for social breakdown to be very rapid in Rwanda. Therefore, elements that are that exists to be able to see that doesn't happen
should not be seen in contradiction to some of these things that you say. Social breakdown can be rapid. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there has to be the ability to see that that does not happen. And the thing about it is social engineering. Yes, Tanzania, by the way, it had a lot of success. It's a very nationalistic country in social engineering. But we don't have...
Laura C. Morehouse College. I have a question for Scott, and maybe it speaks to our friend Ferdinand and also to some of the things the ambassador was talking about. You know, I've been trying to think about when the last time I heard a scholarly paper in political science that was not critical of Rwanda, that was not critical of the regime. And I wonder if maybe you could talk a little bit about why the vast majority of Western scholars are critical and do see this critical narrative as the correct and accurate one. And I suspect that perhaps that has something to do with their experiences conducting research in Rwanda, with the increasingly strict permitting system, the difficulty of doing research on sensitive topics like the Gacaca system, reports of people having to turn over their notes to the local authorities, that kinds of thing. So I wonder if you could talk about that. And then for both you and Jennifer, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why this shift happened. Why did the international public opinion, why has that turned against Rwanda in the last couple of years, or at least the narrative has become more complicated, particularly in the lead up to the 2010 elections? You know, for those of us who've been watching Rwanda for a long time, not much changed in the way politics were carried out in the run-up to the election, but there was a marked difference in the level of attention to it and the response.
David through from CSIS. This is a very polarized society. It consists either of true believers in President Kagame's strategy or critics. You either believe, as our friend over there does, that they're sowing the seeds of democratic growth, or they're sowing the seeds of future disaster, sowing the dragon's teeth. And really, there's very little middle ground if you just look at Rwanda. And it seems to me that there is actually a useful test model. It's not a test model that is particularly attractive to Rwandans, but I think it's the best test model that we have, and that is Burundi. And the Burundian reform process looks very, very messy and very, very problematic in contrast to the Rwandan model of moving forward. But it seems to me that the Burundians are actually grappling with real social, economic, ethnic problems, whereas all too frequently, I think, if you do not believe in the grand strategy, there is no room for any kind of discourse in the Rwandan state. And you're putting really all your eggs in one basket. It might work. I'm willing to concede that that is a possibility. But my own gut reaction would be that it's likely to end in disaster. And therefore, my question is, what can Rwandans learn? What can political scientists who work on Rwanda learn from the Burundian process? Is Burundi a mirror image? Or is it so fundamentally different that there is actually very little that you can sort of pull out to suggest some kind of strategy? I believe that it would actually be instructive to look at the Burundian reform process more closely and try to tease out those elements which are applicable to the Rwandan reform. But then you run into the sort of de Tocquevillian problem that a reform process is at its weakest at the very beginning, that an authoritarian state is fairly secure and can go on for a period of time. Once you begin the reform process, you send signals of weakness. And that is, if you like, the most dangerous period of reform. So how do we get over that sort of initial hurdle to devising a different strategy of moving forward in Rwanda?
Okay, let me address a couple of the points that have been made. Thank you for all the very interesting, helpful comments. With regard to the ambassador's comments and to Mr. Bosco's comments, I hope you're right. I mean, first of all, I hope you're right. I shared David's concern that I don't think you're going to be right, and that's why I'm voicing these concerns. Okay, but I would feel better about it if the trajectory was an upward trajectory of liberalization. And I don't think that's the case in Rwanda. I hope you're right. I hope you're right that the seeds are there for a better future. But I don't think that's been the direction of movement. Okay, we disagree, but that would be my response to that. With regard to, and we could talk about why, I mean, I'm happy to talk about that as well, but just to get to the points. I think that, Laura, first of all, there's a, I don't think the vast majority of scholarship on political science Rwanda is critical, by any means, actually. And the majority of scholarship is on the pre-genocide period, first of all. But I think for the people who were, I think for scholars, maybe you're right that they had some kind of negative experience in their research, but I think it's more that it's the continuity, it's the time, it's the repeat visits, it's the depth, it's getting out of Kigali into rural areas. It's knowing the history of the country a little bit better than more impressionistic policymakers do or students do or whatever. And I think that's part of it. I think also if you talk to veteran scholars who look at Rwandan history, they see very strong parallels with contemporary Rwanda, with pre-1994 Rwanda. And why has there been a shift in political opinion? I think it's a good question. I think there are a number of factors, I'm be a little bit quick in my response, and I'd like to think more about it. I think Congo was a big story. You know, I think eventually the violence that occurred in Congo, for which Rwanda had often direct responsibility, changed people's minds about what was happening inside Rwanda. I think that was a big part of the story. I think that there have been a number of defections from within the ruling party, and I think gave voice to concerns that we had new information. I think third, the election process in 2010, I think was really the sort of major turning point where politicians were arrested, assassinated, journalists were assassinated. You know, we don't know exactly who did it, but certainly it seemed that the people who were quite critical were the ones who were losing their lives or fleeing the country. You know, that's 16 years after the genocide, right? So I think though, if I were to identify a series of factors, it would probably be those. Okay. To Professor Throop's comments, I've thought a lot about this question, the Burundi question, and I have encouraged my graduate students who want to work on Rwanda to look at Rwanda in comparative perspective, particularly with Burundi. And I think one has to, and you know, I've gone back and forth. I sometimes am very optimistic about Burundi's future. You know, it's really messy and, you know, it's disorderly, but everyone's speaking their minds, and that's ultimately going to be a recipe for a more durable peace in the country. But I don't know the answer to that question, and I haven't spent a lot of time in Burundi, and I don't know, people that I speak to who go there don't speak glowingly about, you know, the lives of Burundians, so I'm not sure that it's necessarily a better alternative. But I think the question to ask for Burundi is, At which point does one make the comparison? Is it 1993, 1992, and 1993 with Buyoya? Is it 1996? Is it 2004? Is it, you know, which point in the Burundian cycle do you point to as your reference category? And I don't have an answer to that. But I don't think we can hold up Burundi as a... I think one answer to your question is, Burundi up until 1993 is where Rwanda has been since 1994, and that will end very badly. That's one logical comparison to make. But you can also look at sort of the late 2000s Burundi and say this sort of messy, quasi-consociationalist political system where people speak their minds, but you don't have a lot of economic growth. It's not that stable. There's a chance of a new rebellion in the country. That could also be your point of comparison. And so I don't know. It's a good. I think it's very much worth pursuing that question. So.
a couple of things was, one, the more distant you get from the genocide, I mean, memories here are short. I mean, look at, critiques of Obama and people, it's like we have like a 4-year memory cycle, first of all. I think that moving away from the genocide, people who were in so traumatized by that and by the U.S. Reaction and ashamed of the U.S. reaction, I mean, that's we're moving away from that, and I think people are less that colors their analysis, I think, less of Rwanda. Second, I think Kagame can be a very charming man, but he can also be kind of a bully sometimes to critics. And with the UN mapping report, I mean, I think the Congo issue was very important, but the suppression of some of the reports. I remember the assistant secretary was there at one point. This was in the Bush administration to launch the Starbucks, cooperation. It was kind of an upbeat event, and she mentioned something about governance, and immediately got a smackdown for the president, saying, where were you? And I think that at a certain point, that starts to irk people a little bit, and they say, wait, let's think a little bit more about this. I don't like to come here to get flagellated over the U.S. failure every time. The other thing is this pendulum swing away from the new leaders. I think there was willingness to give them a certain break. They did ensure stability, but now Museveni has been there for a very long time. Melis looks like he's going to be a very, very long time. All of those new leaders, by the way, Isaias, Melis, Kabila, Kagame, were. Involved in some way in war 3 years after they were declared kind of the new leaders of Africa. So I think there's a little bit more nuance now and attention, too, on that whole area of Africa in terms of what are we looking for there, not just now, but kind of in the longer term. And, Libya obviously kind of hammered home in a pretty significant way that we... it's important to look critically at these places, and it's important. These vulnerabilities may not all play out, but it's really important to be thinking about them, and it's important for Rwandans to be thinking about them, and crossing fingers and hoping for the best. I know there's things that are being done, and this idea of planting seeds in education and so forth. I think that's incredibly important. The danger is that expectations in today's world are moving much faster than they were a decade, 20 years ago. Communication is moving much faster. And governments, whether they're in Libya, Tunisia, Cote d'Ivoire, wherever, have to react a lot more nimbly now. And having a 20-year strategic plan is not really that viable in a time when expectations, communication, move so quickly. I want to thank Scott for coming. I really want to thank the ambassador and some of the people who pushed back on this, Ferdinand, Mr. Bosco. I think that's really important. I hope we recognize that people around this table really are hoping the best and working for the best in Rwanda, even if we have divergent views. I think there's a lot that we can learn from each other still. I hope we can have this kind of debate. Each chapter in that, as the ambassador said, would be kind of an interesting focus for a session, and I hope we can do more of that down the line. So, Scott, please join me in thanking Scott.